This is Living Planet.
So I'm riding my bike just 5 minutes down the road from my home to a park where I'm going to an exercise class. It's a Saturday morning, it's 8 a.m, so there's not much traffic around. And suddenly I wake up on the road and there's strangers standing around me and they're telling me not to move. All I know is that my right shoulder is in a lot of pain and I don't really know exactly where I am. And the next thing I know, I'm in an ambulance and the paramedics are trying to get a cannula into me to get some morphine into my body because I'm in so much pain. The next moment I remember is I'm on a stretcher and I'm being wheeled into the hospital and I'm lying in an emergency waiting room in a lot of pain and I really don't know what's going on.
Sarah Allerley has been knocked off her bike by a car that was driving on the wrong side of the road at an intersection near her Sydney home. She doesn't make it to her exercise class that morning in 2015, or for many more to come. In fact, for the next 4 years, her whole existence is turned upside down. And it takes an encounter with the natural world to help her get back on her feet. Welcome to Living Planet. I'm Neil King, and in this episode, we're asking, does nature really have the ability to help us recover from the most difficult moments in our lives?
Eventually, later that day, I go home with my family.
She is given medication and follow-up appointments for her shoulder, which took a nasty hit in the collision. Then her partner Miles and two young daughters accompany her back to their suburban house. While in hospital, and despite the pain, she's telling herself and her friends that plans they have for later that day still stand. But back at home, she realizes she's less herself than she's been letting on.
It's only when I try to read the book that I had been reading that I was very engrossed in, and I can't really read. I can run my eyes over the words, but I can't make sense of the sentences, so it feels like I can't read. The next day, I have my young children. I can't look after them, and I can't really be around them. I find the noise and the commotion in the house just too much to bear.
Because the hospital discharges her hours after the accident, and because she is in a state of shock and on strong painkillers to help with the injury to her shoulder, Sarah doesn't start catastrophizing. But she does acknowledge that she's not her usual self. Her head hurts, and she has little capacity to deal with the familiar bustle of life at home.
I'm telling my family to turn the radio off and turn the TV off and turn the music off and just one conversation at a time in a room, and I just find my brain just can't process the sounds, and it starts to sink in that this is more than a shoulder injury.
She has written off her job as a journalist, not just because her shoulder is in bad shape, but because her head aches and is foggy, and using her brain in the way she would need to for work isn't possible. Over the following weeks, her diary, that used to be full of family work and life commitments, fills with medical appointments. She sees different doctors. But what she doesn't see is any improvement. She's been told to take a break from things like email and texting, so she's not on her devices or reading. She's tired, confused, and still struggling to cope with too much activity around her. She's told the headaches and brain fog could be related to the strong painkiller she's on for her shoulder, but she has her doubts.
But at what point did you realise something is seriously wrong?
It was a very gradual process. I don't think they understood how badly I was injured. Nobody did. I didn't. None of the doctors did. They tried different medications. So they tried various pills and things to see if that would help with the headaches. And they even tried like Botox in my head. I had Botox in my head, which really didn't help, but apparently it does help some people for headaches. I was, if anything, getting worse. I couldn't do a lot, really.
All she really feels able to do is sit out in the garden and stare at the trees.
This was all very scary, but I still didn't know what was happening. And it wasn't until more than a month after the accident that I was referred to a brain injury clinic, and I was referred for an MRI.
The scan is not sensitive enough to pick anything up, but the specialist runs other tests, including one where Sarah has to reel off a certain number of words within a set period of time. As someone who writes for a living, words normally come easily to her. But in the clinic of a brain injury rehab specialist, they don't.
The test was where you have to name, like, words
beginning with a letter of the alphabet, for example.
Yeah, and they're not allowed to be, what is it? They're not allowed to be something.
So proper nouns.
Yeah.
Typically, so it just has to be.
And I really struggled with that. And I remember just thinking, oh, my God, this is really weird that I can't do this. Why is this so hard?
So my memory actually of your cognitive screening that we did was that you generally did very well, but quite well. But in traumatic brain injury, we tend to see in some of this simple cognitive testing a few areas that people do worse than expected, and one of them is that particular test.
She is told she has a mild traumatic brain injury and will make a full recovery. But she's also told she has to accept where she is at, because stress and frustration over her situation is likely to make the headaches worse.
I actually was quite relieved. I remember telling a friend, a parent from my daughter's school, that I was almost excited. I finally got a diagnosis. I know what's going on, because there's something a bit crazy-making about not knowing what's wrong. And brain injuries can be quite invisible when they're mild.
Roughly around the same time that Sarah gets her diagnosis, a different story of invisible unease is starting to take hold thousands of miles away.
I think over time I recognized that as I started to feel more drained. So kind of the daily grind with work, trying to juggle career growth with childcare, recognizing that maybe my current partnership wasn't very balanced and so wasn't getting the support that I needed in that realm. So I think those types of energy drains just started to build over time and become very heavy and weighing on me.
All right, we have breaking news now. Let's get to it. It has to do with COVID-19. And the World Health Organization has just declared a global coronavirus.
By the time the pandemic strikes in 2020, things are coming to a head for Megan Devine. On paper, she is sailing through life. She has a double major undergraduate degree, a doctorate in clinical psychology, is working in Chicago in her own private practice after years of employment at respected clinics. She also has a husband and two young children. But on the inside, all is not well.
I would certainly say burnout. It was probably a bit deeper than that. Since, you know, when relationships start to disintegrate, they can very much shatter your sense of self. You know, my partnership at the time, you know, was not going great, but I tried to, you know, fix it. I tried to work on it. I tried to be small to make it work. I tried to not have needs. But over time, really recognizing that all of those pieces that I was giving up were pieces of myself. This is where I feel like I was a shell. I was, yes, broken.
She sees that staying in her marriage will further erode her sense of self. So getting out feels like her only choice. But she also knows this will not be an easy process, and that she will need time and help to rebuild.
I do recall the feeling of my inner self, my sense of self, being really in 1,000 pieces at my feet and feeling you know, kind of panicky in terms of like, how am I going to put this back together? I don't know how. I don't have the energy. I don't have the support. I don't have the space. I don't have the time. So much of that felt like feverishly digging myself out of a black hole, but never getting closer to the top.
With her family back in her native Minnesota and her friends already busy with their own lives and now having to contend with the unprecedented challenges of an emerging global pandemic, Megan is alone with her situation.
China is expanding COVID lockdowns as infections there are on the rise.
Strict new lockdown has begun in the most populous U.S. state, California.
States and cities cracking down.
Then, as COVID spreads, forcing much of the world, including Chicago, into lockdown, she suddenly finds herself with an unexpected chance to slow down. Not completely, but enough to catch up with her own thoughts.
I didn't have a commute anymore. I was working from home and that. And so I remember thinking, like, I have time to think about myself or my options and being able to fully recognize what I needed at the time, since that was energy that was always being put elsewhere, you know, just functioning or just existing. And really recalling days that I felt like an actual zombie, you know, just trying to get through the day and night too, with this child who didn't sleep always very well. You know, I felt like I wasn't giving my energy just to the daily grind anymore, because I had the time to sit back and figure things out.
It was through walking rather than sitting that Megan begins the process of working things through. One day, one step at a time.
Here in Illinois, in the suburbs, they have very dedicated and well-preserved forest locations along the river. So very accessible. And so I had a chance to revisit that. And that was, you know, something that instantly was a spark for me that was like, oh, the light bulb moment. Like, oh, this is what I've been missing. This is, I can breathe here. I can be here. I can exist here without demands and without conditions. And, you know, and I had time to pay attention to that.
The way you describe that, I think that's also something I think every parent can relate to, the fact that sometimes just finding those spaces where nobody wants anything of you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a peaceful feeling.
That feeling of peace is something Megan remembers well from her upbringing in what she describes as very, very rural Minnesota. Her childhood home was so immersed in forest and farmland that no other houses were visible from her own.
We had a farm as well. And, you know, when I think back on it, the things that stick out most to me were walking out the front door into just this whole other world of nature and animals.
And in 2020, with the very urban life she has built for herself becoming unsustainable and a little more time to spend outside, that memory of her connection with nature resurfaces. Remembering the role it played in her younger years, Megan has an innate understanding of the natural world as a safe and welcoming space. More than that, she starts to notice how different she feels when she is in the forest near her Chicago home. The local woodlands become a refuge for her.
I had a sense of, oh, I'm not alone. I can do it. And so really remembering that the forest was such a force for me in feeling, in being able to access my own strength. I try to walk the same path in the woods every day. And when I'm there, I become a part of the forest. I become a part of the woods. I have a space there. I have a home there. And it feels, you know, familiar and, yeah, just a really sense of belonging.
Can you perhaps describe that walk? Because I've got one of those walks as well. It's a special walk. And whenever I have to make a decision or whenever I feel a bit down, it's got a perfect length for me. It's about 10K. and it's this little stream. I've got the sound of water. I've got lovely trees. The sun shines through the trees in parts.
Yeah, so the path is a gravel pathway through the woods, winding. And there's a river, the north branch of the Chicago River is on my right side, pretty flowing. It never freezes in the winter because it's a pretty quick-moving river. Lots of very big, wise trees, I feel. And I think some of the animals who are maybe expecting me, some of the deer and the ducks aren't frightened of me anymore because I'm there every day at the same time. And just thinking of, you know, the crunch under my feet, the clouds and the sun and, you know, how it dapples through the branches and hits the trail. And there's so much to pay attention to. There's so much to notice. And it's like a different walk every day, even though it's the same place.
Never gets old.
Never gets old.
She begins to understand the role nature can and is playing in helping to move through this difficult time in her life.
I felt that after living a shell of my former self for so many years, I could finally crack that open. And I was, you know, able to be me and really feeling that the trees there were witnesses for me. They were there with me. They were seeing my sadness and anger and holding that with me and sharing that space with me. And it felt I was with it. I was with the forest. I was like weaved in. I was part of it. I think of that as the beginning of this relationship with the forest, like a dedicated attention that I was giving to the forest, and it was giving it back to me in a way that felt really nurturing and really healing.
The mental health benefits of time spent in the forest are well documented. One recent meta-study into forest bathing, which originated in Japan in the 1980s, found the practice can significantly reduce symptoms of depression and anxiety. But a rapidly increasing body of research suggests it's not only woodlands that can enhance the way people feel. A 2021 US study found evidence for associations between exposure to nature and improved cognitive function, brain activity, blood pressure, physical activity and sleep. And last year, researchers in Australia found that people who feel connected to nature and regularly visit public green space have lower stress, anxiety and depression scores than people who don't. So what exactly is going on there?
There is a really consistent body of research showing that people who are struggling with emotional difficulties gain quite a bit from nature. Nature seems to absorb pain in a way. In some studies, we've shown that it tends to reduce depression, tends to reduce anxiety, stress at times. It puts things in perspective for people. That sense of feeling connected to everything and realizing that you're part of a bigger picture. And when that happens, it gives you a bit of relief and it makes you see things in a different light.
Holly Ann Passmore is Associate Professor at the Department of Psychology at Canada's Concordia University of Edmonton. Her research includes how nature can impact human well-being. And she says there are some clear explanations for how it works.
There's two types of attention, essentially, and all this is from an evolutionary point of view. So there's hard attention or direct attention. So that's something you're in a class, you're reading a book, you're driving. Nature, though, captures our attention in the way that's generally called soft fascination. So it is the difference between a flashing neon sign that you can't ignore, that reaches out and basically, look at me, right? And that takes brain energy. Whereas things in nature tend to capture your attention, but it's a soft fascination. It's not reaching out and shaking you by the shoulder saying, look at me. And from a neuroimaging framework, we can see that people are using fewer resources in their brain. And of course, when you do that, what are you doing? You're giving your brain a break. You're actually allowing your brain to recover. And that's why people have this sense of restored attention. And that leads to a sense of emotional restoration as well.
But what about physical brain health? Can contact with nature aid recovery from the kind of mild traumatic brain injury Sarah Allerley suffered after being knocked off her bike?
So I had a real light bulb moment. It was October and the accident happened in August. And I was invited to go on a bushwalk with some friends and I took my kids. And it was the first day since the accident that I hadn't had a headache. And it was extraordinary. And I was, there's something about being in the bush, in the forest, in nature that is really working and is really good for me. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew that something had changed. And then as soon as we were in the car home and I started looking at Google Maps, a direct for my friend, the headache started coming back. So I said to my specialist, so this thing happened. I went for this bushwalk, this hike, and my headaches went away and I had this great day. And he wasn't particularly surprised. He kind of explained it as being, well, that's because you'd sort of be focusing on, you'd have something stimulating in the nature, in the bush, but that it's not going to be aggravating.
Which chimes with the idea of soft fascination. When 2015 turns to 2016 and Sarah still has headaches and has not yet gone back to work, she's feeling anxious and depressed and wondering if things will ever go back to the way they were before the accident. As a New Zealander who grew up going on hikes, she's no stranger to time spent in the great outdoors. But after this positive experience, she now turns towards nature more decisively.
I then started going for quite deliberate, slow walks around my neighbourhood along a local river, just looking at gardens, and I'd really notice how I'd come back and the depression and the anxiety had lifted. It was very noticeable. The headaches would go away. I'd feel clearer. My focus and concentration would be better. It would be easier to have a conversation and just be around groups of people. And I would feel that my brain just, I just feel this kind of almost like a fog lifting and also like, and like a clarity, but also like the pressure of any headaches lifting. It just was, so then I'd feel more relaxed.
She also notices that if she goes on a full day walk by herself, she can't find herself feeling better for an entire week.
So the effects would carry on. And so I think the effects are, they're not, they're immediate, but they're also lasting.
Though at the time there isn't anything like the volume of research on the topic that there is in the post-pandemic world, Sarah comes across an article and a book connecting time in nature with improved concentration and overall mental health. What she can't find, though, is anything linking time outdoors with mild traumatic brain injury. So she decides to embark on her own research project, which becomes a podcast she calls Brain on Nature.
No one's telling me to do this, but it's obviously working. No one seems to have done any research, so I'll do my own research and I'll find out what works for me and tell other people about it, because there must be other people that have had brain injuries that could also benefit from this.
As part of that research, she interviews her neurologist and asks whether, based on her positive experience of spending time in nature, he would suggest other patients do the same. His answer is that while there is evidence of how being in nature benefits general brain function, there is none relating to brain injury, and that he can only prescribe things with a scientific base.
And he was very pragmatic. He said, because I'm a neurologist and I can't tell them to just go and sit on a rock and look at the ocean, because that just doesn't fit in with the model of medicine that they're practicing. And I said, well, would you tell other people, now you know I've had this experience and you've seen that, would you now tell another patient? And he was like, well, I could tell them to sort of listen to your podcast and hear your experience.
And many have. Over the years, Sarah has received messages from lots of people with brain injuries, some recounting a similar experience and others saying how listening to her story prompted them to spend more time in the natural world with positive outcomes. Research conducted in Europe last year found that even brief exposure to nature can help some people feel a reduction in pain. Polly Ann Passmore says it makes sense that spending time in nature could have a positive impact on the physical body.
One of the things when you're in nature is that aspect of giving your brain a bit of a break is going to help. This is why people who have concussions, what the first thing to do is just, okay, don't be looking at the computer, don't be reading, don't be using, just like a muscle, you have to stop using it for a while to let it recover. I think that's one of the reasons. I think from an emotional aspect, our emotions have an incredible impact on our physical well-being. When you're in a better emotional state, it doesn't matter what kind of injury a person has, your body is going to respond more effectively, more efficiently, be able to recover.
By the time Sarah does eventually return to work, she's been off for 8 months. She eases back in gently and on a part-time basis. And although her life soon fills back up with commitments, she continues to make time and space for walking or just being in nature. In fact, it becomes a habit she still nurtures all these years later.
I'm very conscious now when I'm like, oh, I'm feeling like a bit out of sorts and not feeling that great in physical and mental health ways. I will actually deliberately go for a bushwalk and spend some time in nature. So on Sunday morning, I went and did a regular walk that I do quite regularly. And it is very good, I think, in terms of your sort of nature reconnection and the benefits you get from the brain, to actually just go back to the same places, because then it's less about like, which way am I going? Oh, look at this new thing. Am I going the right way? You know, how much further? And you're actually just really can sort of sink in quite deeply, but also by noticing the little things that are different, like, oh, that the leaves are changing, or there's a different birds around at this time of day, or the light's different, or the weather's changing, that's actually connecting you more with the natural world.
And that connection can have a deep reach. There have been various studies over the past years seeking to assess how much time we should be spending in nature. The results differ, but as far as Holly Ann Passmore sees it, the more important metric is attention.
I think that we get off track when we're focusing on what's the dose, because that goes back to this kind of medical model of it, right? What's the dose? Oh, I have this. Oh, take a pill. I have this. I have to do this. And it's not quite how it works. It's not just time. It's noticing it. It's engaging with it. And it doesn't have to be in a way that takes time out of your day.
She asks people in her research groups to notice how the nature in their environment makes them feel. And her results consistently reveal the potential benefits from using whatever time is available to observe what is already there.
Paying attention to the nature in your everyday life and noticing how it made you feel had these incredibly large boosts on different aspects of well-being, and not just positive emotions, but things like feeling connected to other people, to life in general. A sense of elevation, which is a composite emotion composed of awe, a deep gratitude, and being profoundly moved. That wasn't from spending more time in nature.
Which is good news in our urban-centric existence, where not everyone has easy access to green space. Holly Ann says we tend to think of nature as being out there, somewhere beyond the city, in mountains or by the ocean. But we don't need to look that far away to reap the benefits.
Such an important message is this aspect that nature is all around us. You look out the window. There's the sky. There's a tree. There's a bird. We know from many pieces of research that even just having plants in your office or in your room enhances well-being.
Paying attention to the details of nature on her regular walk is also a big part of Megan Devine's story. 5 years after the pandemic, she too is in a better place and sees the benefits of her time among the trees so clearly that she embarks on further study in what is known as ecotherapy. She wants to incorporate it into her work as a psychologist.
I've experienced that this element of healing is can be very like absent and missing from traditional psychotherapy, that this nature connection, that humans are nature, that we've evolved in relationship with nature. And so reconnecting that piece, I think, can provide a sense of wholeness that people might struggle to fill, or that feel like I was feeling was missing for such a long time. You know, I started my youth with that connection, and then being able to return to that as an adult, having, you know, struggled through a lot of challenging years, and to be able to rebuild that for myself has propelled me in wanting to help other people find that as well.
Like Sarah, Megan has maintained her own relationship with the nature around her, still walking that same calming and familiar route among the trees as often as she can. And both women see how committing to the relationships they built with the natural world that supported them through some of their most challenging days can inspire a wish to give something back.
I think that the more people that understand the benefits and the importance of spending time in the natural world and how powerful it can be, I also hope will mean that we'll, like, one of my aims of making Brain on Nature and telling people my story was just that people would be inspired to look after our natural world.
I really want to retain that childlike enthusiasm for how amazing nature can be, while also at the same time recognizing that I also would like to contribute. I also want to provide love and care to the nature that's around me in any way that I can, and make it a truly, you know, reciprocal, mature relationship, you know, while also having those everyday moments of awe as well.
This episode of Living Planet was produced by Tamsin Walker and edited by me, Neil King. Our sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. With thanks also to Sarah Allerley for allowing us to use a snippet of conversation from her Brain on Nature podcast. Living Planet is available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. What do you think of this episode? We'd love to hear your thoughts, so please do send us a message. Our email address is livingplanet@dw.com. Of course, you can also leave a rating or review on the podcast platform of your choice. Living Planet is produced by DW in Bonn, Germany.
When was the last time you said, I never thought about it that way? The Current aims to give you that moment every single day. Hello, I'm Matt Galloway, and our award-winning team brings you stories and conversations to expand your worldview. Sometimes they connect to the news of the day, sometimes to the issues of our time. And you'll hear all kinds of people on The Current, from best-selling authors to maybe your neighbor. Find us wherever you get your podcasts, now including YouTube. I'll talk to you soon.